Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you. I appreciate Erica and the other other organizers inviting me to join you to try and summarize for you and then discuss with you some work I've been doing off and on for the past 6 or 7 years, thinking about the migration of open source models out of the software area into scientific research, and in particular into the biomedical sciences. And as with so many other things that academics do, initially we, when I began thinking about this and then some other folks joined me, we didn't know there was anything more than kind of an interesting idea, and it's turned out, I think, to be actually quite significant as time has gone on. So I thought I would start by summarizing a little bit what the landscape looks like. Several aspects of open source models that seem to me to be significant, and I think are proving to be significant with regard to scientific research. The first is some work I did in the area of open source genomics, that as the Human Genome Project began to map and sequence the DNA complement of the human species, and then moved also into other species, other models, various worms and plants and creatures who would be good scientific models, it became apparent that there was some conflict between the norms of scientific research and the expectations of the scientific community and the intellectual property possibilities that presented themselves for that research. And it seemed that there was a possibility that scientists had begun to and would increasingly begin to adopt some type of open source strategy to try and mediate those conflicts. So that strand of the inquiry sort of thinks about the comparison and contrast between the culture of science, the norms of scientific research, and the culture of software development or the norms of the open source software community. A second strand that has emerged or become apparent over the past few years is the related question of open source patenting or open source biology. From a legal standpoint, to what extent can we take a model that was developed for one product and one intellectual property regime, specifically for software and really a copyright-based intellectual property regime, and port that over to a different area, particularly in the biomedical sciences, where we're thinking really about not just a different type of technology, but a whole different intellectual property regime, primarily the regime of patent. And so we have to think then about the differences and similarities between software licensing and biotechnology licensing. And then a third strand that I've thought about and that I'm looking forward to discussing with you here is really the most recent, which is the emergence of what in the U.S. we're calling cyber infrastructure, what the British are calling e-science, which is the increasing use of computer networks, communication technologies to do collaborative science in ways that perhaps weren't possible before, in virtual environments that allow certain types of experiments and collaborations and sharing of data, sharing of resources, including physical resources. Since that is a potentially trans-border proposition, since those are collaborations that don't need to be tied down to a particular physical location, we begin to have some of the problems that are familiar to those who studied the internet for a while, the problems of jurisdiction, the problems of different nations, different jurisdictions having different legal regimes, and to what extent do those conflict, to what extent can those conflicts be mediated, and specifically, can they be mediated by licensing schemes, by open source licensing or contractual types of schemes that might be adopted to avoid some of those types of problems? And that's some of the most recent thinking that I've done. So we've got kind of a diverse group here, and I suppose also logged on to the webcast elsewhere. So I thought it would be worthwhile to just make sure we're on the same page with regard to a couple of things. The next couple of slides will be very familiar to some of you, maybe less familiar to others. First of all, when we talk about open science and the norms of science and what scientific research is about, what do we mean? There have been various opinions advanced in different disciplines. Very frequently, we hear discussion of so-called scientific norms or Mertonian norms. They go back to some work that sociologist Robert Merton did in the early to mid-20th century. And some version of these norms tends to show up in most of the discussion that you hear about open science. Merton went out and sort of looked at what scientists were doing, what they told him they thought they were doing. That work has been debated and contested, but probably most people who worked in science would view some version of this as being what they think that they're doing. What they're actually doing may be different. So Merton found a set of expectations or norms that he believed scientists thought they were operating under. The first one he originally called communism. That didn't go over too well in the 50s, so he changed the name to communalism. The idea that if you're doing scientific research, if you're in the scientific community, and you develop data, you develop information through your investigation, that really belongs to the community in some sense. You ought to share it with other scientists, that it should be accessible and open to the community. Second norm or belief that he identified was what he called universalism, that scientific truth was just scientific truth, and if you found some interesting information or you did good work, it didn't matter whether it came from an undergraduate student or a Nobel laureate or someone in the United States or someone in the former Soviet Union, that it would be the same everywhere and it should be valued the same everywhere. You should be valued for what you do, not for your status or for whom you are. Then there was a norm of independence. The scientists ought to be able to operate independently, sort of go wherever their bliss takes them, investigate whatever seems important to them, as free from constraint as possible. Obviously, there are practical constraints as to funding and to the organization that you're part of, but you ought to be able to explore what nowadays people like Ed Felton might call the freedom to tinker, you know, sort of go wherever you want to and investigate what you please. All of this, Merton found, was subject to what he called organized skepticism, which were institutional mechanisms to vet or to test the information that was found and was proposed. So before it became part of the canon of scientific information, it had to go through some sort of a process of peer review and publication, optimally reproducing the experiments at some point, criticism and presentation to the community. And when it had been through this process of being vetted, then it could be somehow certified as scientific knowledge and permitted into the canon. And then in some of his later work, he also decided that scientists valued something he called originality, which was, yes, it's important to reproduce other people's experiments to sort of test them and to validate them, but really what scientists really valued was something fresh, something original. They really valued information that wasn't sort of the norm, information that was exciting and interesting and could capture their attention. Now, obviously, people pointed out scientists don't always behave like this. If you've ever worked in science, you know that there may be a tendency to not share your data with others freely, especially if you don't want to be scooped on publication. There may be a tendency to not value information, no matter where it comes from, to take Nobel laureates more seriously than undergraduate students, and so on. But frequently that is accompanied by some degree of discomfort, some feeling that that is a deviation. So there's deviant behavior from all of these norms, but the fact that people feel bad about it or feel guilty about it may indicate that the norm is in fact there. And the driver for all of this, Merton said, was reputational reward. You don't make a whole lot of money as a scientist typically, but if you do all these things, you do good work, share your information with the community, allow it to be vetted by this process of organized skepticism, then you gain respect and the adulation of your peers, And the big deal about the Nobel Prize is, of course, not that there's some money attached, although the money is nice, but really it's that you are recognized as being a valuable member of the community, and that's what people are really out to get from this. Now, back in the 1980s, a number of people, Rebecca Eisenberg, I think, really led the way on this, Rob Merges, some others, they said, well, you know, those kinds of norms or some version of that seems to motivate scientists to do interesting work and to develop valuable knowledge. You know, maybe they don't behave themselves in exactly that way all the time, but certainly this business of reputational reward seems to be an important driver for scientific research. And we have another system in society and the law for motivating research, which is the intellectual property system. And that's always been sort of there in parallel, but they came together in a very dramatic way, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s with the boom in biotechnology, biomedical science, the availability of patents for living organisms and for the results of recombinant DNA research. And so a question arose, are scientists going to be more motivated by this reputational reward? Are they going to be more motivated by the potential financial reward of intellectual property, of patents? And there are a couple of points that are worth making there. First of all, again, I think Becky Eisenberg was the first to point this out. You know, patents are looked down upon by scientists, or were traditionally looked down upon by scientists, as being sort of crass, you know, sort of commercial, and that's really why you're supposed to be doing things. You're supposed to share your data, not exclude people from your data. So patents might be disfavored. On the other hand, you know, offering somebody a patent beats some other possible intellectual property regimes like trade secrecy. You know, trade secrecy would be really bad for communalism and really bad for open science, because if you try and keep your data as a trade secret, then it's much more restricted than it would be in the patent system. At least patents require you to disclose and publish what you've discovered in return for 20 years or so of exclusive rights. So maybe patents are better than trade secrets, although they still may not be entirely compatible with those expectations of the scientific community. And this became very apparent as the Human Genome Mapping and Sequencing Project began to really gather steam in the 90s. A fellow by the name of Craig Venter developed a methodology for very quickly sequencing short snippets of DNA from active genes, so-called ESTs, expressed sequence tags. And at the time, he was working for the National Institutes of Health in the United States, for NIH. And the patent counsel there at NIH, a guy named Reed Adler, said, well, you know, these are molecules. Molecules are patentable. And I think we ought to file patents on these snippets of DNA that you're able to discover. And so they began filing applications out of NIH with the U.S. Patent Office, sometimes on as many as 2,000 of these short sequences per application. And one of the reasons given by Adler was, he said, we can get patents and sort of use them in a strategic position to keep science open. Now, if we have the patent, somebody else won't have the patent. Some commercial firm won't have the patent. And we can kind of dedicate it to the public. Our having a patent, you know, would preclude other patents. And so as long as the good guys have the patents, people won't be excluded by the patents. The research community pretty much rejected that. There was a huge outcry over these NIH patent applications. The government eventually withdrew those patent applications. Venter left NIH, took his technology and founded a couple of biotech startups, and began filing his own patent applications, not to keep things open, but in sort of a proprietary manner as part of a private company that he had developed with a business model of selling the information that he was locking up to people who were doing biomedical investigation. That really caused a lot of consternation in the community because of the way that patents were viewed kind of negatively. And so the publicly funded research community began sequencing the genome as fast as they could and partnering actually with some large traditional pharmaceutical companies like Merck, and trying to throw the information to the public domain as fast as they could, up in publicly accessible databases on the internet. In fact, they reached a sort of an agreement, the so-called Bermuda rules, where they agreed that they would, within 24 hours of sequencing something, make the data available publicly, and that public disclosure before the filing of a patent application can help to block other people from getting patents. And this seems to have worked relatively well. Ventnor's companies eventually gave up on their business model, went off to do other things, and there was sort of much rejoicing by the publicly funded scientific community, which struck me as a little odd. But if you thought about any other sort of industry, automotive industry or take your pick, aviation, electronics, would there be great rejoicing if government subsidized R&D managed to drive out private entrepreneurs? Typically in a free market society, we don't like that. We think it's a bad idea. But here, people seem to think it was a good idea, that the government had essentially forced some people out of business or forced them out of a particular business model. So that is interesting and worth thinking about. Now, as I said, most recently, we've seen attempts in the United States and in Britain and in some other countries to develop online collaborations between scientists to create virtual environments where they can do work. This is happening sort of naturally with the internet, where people put information up in public repositories and share it and access it, much the way that I talked about with the Human Genome Project, but there are lots of other repositories now also. There is discussion of building so-called grid technology with an analogy to the power grid, where you can sort of share resources as it's networked. That would enable sharing of resources, including high-throughput computing systems, and so-called collaboratories, right? Virtual environments where this work could be done. As I mentioned, that creates a bit of a problem, because if you are discovering something with someone in one of these collaboratories, you don't really care where they're physically located. That's the whole point. But the law does care where they're located. Will the patent law of the United States or of France or Japan apply to what's going on? Because this law is territorial. And we have some ability to sort of sort that out and decide on basis of conflicts of law principles whose law should apply, but it's not without problem. In particular, the United States has a number of rules that assign inventorship based on where you're located, and so those could be problematic. Or if you're in one of these collaboratories and you are using some information or using an invention that might be patented in one or another country, will you be liable for infringement? And that problem has appeared, for example, very recently in the BlackBerry case, the RM case, where the handheld PDA BlackBerry device was accused of infringing certain patents in the United States. Research in Motion, RM, said, well, part of the invention is actually located in Canada. Part of our network is located in Canada, outside the United States, so it doesn't infringe. And the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit said, well, that doesn't actually matter. As long as it extends into the United States in some sense, you're an infringer. So that could potentially happen with these so-called collaboratories or with these data repositories that are sharing. So again, can you perhaps adopt some type of agreement beforehand that would help you to avoid these kinds of problems? Open source licensing has been proposed as a possibility for all of these. I don't want to say a whole lot here, because I think this group probably knows the open source mantra pretty well. I'll point out that there are typically two justifications for open source type of licensing. A pragmatic one, which is, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So you ought to make your code transparent, you ought to make it available, and lots of people can work on it, and you just get a better product at the end of the day. The other one is sort of the Richard Stallman approach. This is an ethical thing. You have a moral obligation to share your technology with others, and as a consequence, you should do that. The problem, of course, is once you put it out there, how do you keep someone else from capturing it and making it proprietary? And the idea is that you have some licenses that are attached to the code, that travel with the code, that prevent that from happening. There's a range of these, the most famous being the sort of copyleft approach. But if you think about that, that tries to instantiate some communal norms that are very similar to those scientific norms we talked about a minute ago, the so-called hacker ethic, you know, that you ought to share your code with the community, that you should be respected for producing a good product no matter who you are, but you gain reputational rewards and reputational advantages for participating in and contributing to the project. We don't want you to defect or fork the project, and so what's the deterrent to doing that? Well, some type of shame or communal disapproval does most of that, and there are a number of interesting empirical studies that show that projects like the Linux kernel project is actually very highly structured, you know, with team leaders, and it's just not acceptable to sort of take things in a different direction than that team leader wants to go. If you want to do that, go start your own project, but don't do it with this project. So there's very strong normative constraints, and that's backed up by these licenses. You know, if you sort of go off and try and do something improper, especially something commercial and proprietary with what we've created as a community, we might subject you to a copyright suit based on the license that we've attached to the code. So can science, can biomedical sciences adopt this type of licensing scheme? Well, there's been some attempts to do so. I'll mention a couple of examples that we can talk about, although there are lots. We don't have time to think about all of them. The Haplotype Mapping Project, which again is one of these publicly accessible repositories of information, has adopted an open source type of license. If you access the information, you agree that you sort of won't take it and do proprietary things with it, and if you discover new information with it, that you'll then put that back into the common pool. So that's an attempt to use open source types of models for a database. The BIOS project, which I've been involved in a little bit, which I'm probably most familiar with of all these examples, an attempt by some folks out of Australia to make available some actual research tools, physical tools, enzymes and genes and other types of tools for agricultural research, and they don't want to make those available and have them again be captured, have someone take them and make them proprietary in some way. So in order to get access to these tools, they ask you that you will agree to a license that travels with the actual physical molecules, which attempts to distinguish between improvements on the tools, which they want you to put back into the common pool so other people can use the research tool, and products that you create. They're happy to have you patent a discovery that is not the tool itself. They just don't want the tools to be locked up and unavailable to others. So improvements go back into the community, but you can do whatever you want with other kinds of products that you develop with the tools. And then the Science Commons project related to Creative Commons, an attempt to try and make the literature of science available, sounding, again, mostly here in copyright, not so much in patent. So those are all examples of attempts to do this. Legal impediments that we need to think about as we're doing this, well, as I said, in situations like the BIOS project or similar types of projects where patent is really at issue rather than copyright, we need to think about the differences between patent and copyright. And a big one is the fact that copyright has an independent development defense, right? You don't infringe a copyright unless you copy. And that, in fact, is what triggers these licenses that travel with the code in open source types of projects. The assumption is that when you copy or when you somehow manipulate that code, you do so under the agreement that you'll obey the license, and so that's actually the trigger for the license. Now, patent doesn't have that. You cannot know about a patent, you cannot have access to the patented technology and develop it independently and still be an infringer. And so that trigger for activating the license is not available in the same way in the patent space as it has been in the copyright space. And in fact, that has worried software folks because patents might cover open source developments and not be subject to the license. And it could also be an issue in the biomedical or scientific space. Then there are a number of competitive concerns. I won't go into these in any great detail. I've got a paper about this. You can find it on SSRN. You can find it through my website at the University of Minnesota. I'll just kind of mention these in passing, that we tend to scrutinize patents much more carefully for antitrust and anti-competitive concerns than we do copyright. Sure, we get worried about copyright sometimes. Microsoft found that out, that there could be antitrust concerns about copyrighted inventions. But for the most part, patents get more scrutiny. We have certain rules about, for example, companies pooling their patents. Well, some of these projects look like patent pools. For example, the BIOS project. You know, you're putting all of this patented inventions into a common communal resource. And so we have rules to think about and hopefully avoid antitrust concerns when that happens. We also get concerned about some types of patent licenses, that they could be anti-competitive. Some of these open source models look a little bit like the so-called reach-through license, you know, where I license something to you and you then have to pay me based on what you develop with that. Think about what I said about BIOS. That sounds a little bit like the BIOS license. Or so-called grant-back licenses, where I license a patent invention to you and you agree to give me some sort of access to or proprietary interest in improvements that you develop. These licenses actually, my co-author Sarah Bottinger and I have called reverse reach through or reverse grant back, right? Because you're actually agreeing in some instances not to patent what you develop or not to exercise exclusive rights in what you develop. But there still could potentially be antitrust concerns there, similar to the ones we've seen in other types of patent licensing. And then the question of misuse. Misuse is a doctrine that says Congress in the United States, the government has given you these exclusive rights and intellectual property, and you're supposed to use them in certain ways. And if you use them badly, that could be an equitable violation. In particular, a concern here that Robin Feldman out of Hastings Law School has looked at is since some of these licenses seem to be trying to discourage patenting. You know, I'm going to license my patented technology to you on the agreement that you won't patent what you develop with it. Is that sort of against the organic public policy of the United States? You know, we think patents are good. We have them in the Constitution. The patent policy of the United States is you're supposed to get patents. They encourage innovation. These models assume that patents don't necessarily encourage innovation. So if you're discouraging patents, is that a misuse of your patent, you know, using your patent to prevent patents? Then finally, we need to think about some cultural impediments. Software development is not exactly like biomedical science or other kinds of science. Institutionally, for example, science has a much more structured set of institutions than the open source community really does. Science is, for example, closely allied in many cases with academic research institutions, not-for-profit universities, and so on. They have an interest in how things develop, so that could complicate matters. Funding agencies, a great deal of scientific research is funded by government or other types of grant agencies, and they frequently put strings on the money that they give, and they have interests in how things develop. And then just the structure of scientific research groups, whether you're talking about really large science, you know, sort of huge physics, high-energy physics projects, or human genome mapping type projects, or even smaller laboratories, there's a very defined structure to how laboratories function. Those differences might need to be taken into account. And then some systemic differences, right? Science has these institutions like peer-reviewed journals, which is sort of the key entry point to science. And that's not quite like what you see in open source software development. And scientific societies, the professional societies, you know, can be very important. And other institutions of organized skepticism. So those might need to be taken into account if we're developing licenses for science that would parallel the open source model because they don't look quite like what we see in the software development area. So that was kind of my hit the high points of what I thought about in this area for the past little while. Open to questions and either here or virtually, I guess. Stunned silence. Sir.
Can you say a little more about the patent misuse arguments?
Questions? Yeah. So the patent misuse argument runs something like this. in patent misuse, and for that matter, copyright misuse, because we have both doctrines, at least in U.S. law, we say we gave you these exclusive rights. The public, the government granted you some exclusive rights to do certain things, to promote progress, to give an incentive to recoup the investment you made in developing some new innovation that will benefit the public. And the assumption there is that that's good, right? That these incentives will spur you forward and will cause you to do good things for the economy and for the public in general. And if you misuse that, particularly by licensing it in a bad way, we might refuse to enforce your exclusive rights. So if you overreach in some way, if you try and use your patent to force people to take a tied license, you know, something that you wanted to buy plus something you didn't want to buy, or if we, if you use your exclusive rights in patent or copyright to go beyond the term that was set for the exclusive rights, you know, beyond the 20 years of the patent, that's a big no-no. I can charge you whatever I want to for 20 years, but 21 years, that's off limits. And so if you try and do those kinds of things, we say that's a misuse, and we won't enforce your intellectual property rights until you have purged, quote-unquote, the misuse. And you've stopped doing it and corrected whatever bad effects or market distortions came from that. If you have these kinds of open source licenses, particularly if they involve patents, and you write certain terms into them, for example, if you say, I will license you this patented research tool, this patented invention, on the term that you don't patent anything you discover with it. Or that if you do patent what you discover with it, that you offer a royalty-free license to the world, right? Which would be a pretty typical open source type of expectation. You might argue that that is using your patent to discourage the thing that we think is good, which is more patenting, you know, getting royalties for inventions and so on. And that argument, or a version of that argument, has actually come up in the software context, right? You remember the, you know, the SCO fights about licensing. And one of the arguments that was made by that company was open source is evil because it discourages the development of intellectual property and the obtaining of intellectual property, which public policy in the United States says is good. Now, that argument never went anywhere, but it is still lurking there in the background. It's something you would have to worry about if you're drafting an open source patent license. Say, well, you know, I want to make sure I don't run afoul of this public policy. And I said, Robin Feldman has a nice paper, actually, in the Minnesota Law, Minnesota Journal of Law, Science, and Technology, where she tries to explore those possibilities. And she argues that ultimately she thinks that these licenses could be pro-competitive and wouldn't be a misuse, but the problem is lurking there. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name's Craig again. If I'm funding this nonprofit I started with my profit job at 10% of the commission, but my profit job backed out. Now, am I still allowed to use that 10% commission to fund this?
Well, I'm not licensed to practice law in Massachusetts, so I can't answer that question. Yes.
He used an example, I can't remember which one, and he talked about the fact that people who are involved in this project basically say they will not try and get a patent for any of their primary research or other things that occur during the course of the research itself. You might want to call it like for a secondary patent. So
right.
Something that wasn't a direct result, but can be patented nonetheless. And I'm wondering, in an open environment like the internet, do you think that that's as much of a difficult issue? I mean, that seems to be like a much harder issue to me to deal with than the question of who owns the rights to these patents. Like, if you want members involved to basically say, I will not try and patent anything, that's a much stronger statement than saying, I agree to work on this one project, and I will not patent that.
Yeah. And a large part of that, and it's actually worth going to, for example, the BIOS website to see how they tried to parse that out. And I've talked to them about this a little bit. They've tried to do that on the basis of the claims. Right? So if you look at a patent, you know, the structure of the document is you've got a disclosure that tells you what the invention is and what it's good for in text or drawings or both. And then you have a series of claims at the end of the document that try and give you a textual border as to what I'm, you know, what I say that I own and what I say that I don't own. So to try and divide those out, right, because there's a, as you say, a sort of a fuzzy boundary, fuzzy border there. They've tried to say, well, look, if what you develop, would fall within the claims or within what's called the doctrine of equivalence, you know, an equivalent area around the claims, then we're going to say that's part of the original thing that we licensed to you. It's an improvement on what we licensed to you. And so you can't get a patent on that, or if you do get a patent on that, you've got to dedicate it back to the pool. Right? But if it would be outside the claims, then it's a separate thing, and we don't care what you do. You know, that's your own independent development, and you can patent that or share it or do whatever you want to. So there is actually a little bit of advantage in the open source patenting situation that we don't have in the copyright situation, which is that we have these claims that we can look at, and at least if you know how to read claims, that's kind of an art in itself. But if you look at these claims, you can try and decide, oh, this is related to what I got in the first place, or it's not related to what I got in the first place, and you can try and parse things out that way. In the open source code area, we have all kinds of fuzzy questions that we really can't answer very easily. Because we don't have this statement as to what the invention is or what the thing is. The issue du jour, which Eben Moglen and some other folks have been talking about recently, is if I have some sort of software application that's subject to the new general public license, for example, and it interoperates with some other piece of software on the platform, is that interoperation subject to the open source license, to the free software license? They say yes. They claim that that at least temporarily creates a derivative work under copyright law that is subject to the license. Now, I think that's a very dicey proposition.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, when you switch off the machine, that thing you interoperated with goes back to the state that it was in originally, more or less. It's not clear that you have created derivative work. But for various strategic reasons, they would like it to be subject to the license. Otherwise, you may be able to get around the license. I don't think you're going to have those kinds of problems in the patent space. You'll have some other problems, but not those kinds of problems. So the claims may help with the problem that you're pointing out, I think. I'm not sure who was first, but yeah, please.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think there's a fundamental difference between the kinds of innovations that are promoted by open source kind of things and mm-hmm. the kinds of innovations that ought to be promoted by patents and proprietary considerations?
It's not the $10,000 question anymore. It's the $100 million question. Mm-hmm. The short answer is that we don't know. But it's entirely possible that may be the case. Part of the reason that people started looking at the science community and the research done by the science community back in the 80s from an intellectual property perspective was looking for alternatives to the intellectual property system. Because we have this economic argument that you need a property right, you need a strong property right, you need this incentive to get people to develop interesting stuff. Well, are there examples of places where that's not the case? You can actually come up with lots of examples, but one of the best ones is the scientific community. They tended to reject intellectual property, as they did with the human genome example, for a long time. And yet they still did very important work that benefits society generally. And so that seems to suggest that you can get along without an intellectual property regime, at least in some instances. Now, having said that, remember that that's heavily subsidized by government funding or by student tuition. Or by sort of other inputs, right? That's not self-sustaining the way that a private company out in the marketplace utilizing intellectual property incentive hopefully is. So if you're going to rely on these kinds of reputational rewards, you may have to have some influx of funds to allow people to eat regularly in order for this to happen. And that may be the same situation with regard to open source types of development, right, where you're trying to keep the development open, where you're trying not to assert proprietary rights or be closed. You know, Yochai Benkler has this great book on the wealth of networks and some other writings that he's done, and he points to various types of so-called peer production, open source software being one of them. The funny thing about them is none of them appear to be self-sustaining. Right? I mean, all the folks who are doing open source software development either, you know, have a day job or their university is supporting them, or sometimes a private employer will say, yeah, you can work on this for some strategic reason that we like, or in order to develop some expertise. But they don't seem to be self-sustaining. And the other examples he gives, like, you know, sort of the Mars Crater Project and things like that, again, don't seem to be producing revenue that would allow them to operate independently. So one of the things we do have to worry about is whether these kinds of open approaches are self-sustaining. The examples we have so far don't seem to be.
Can I just follow up on the
sure,
issue?
Yeah.
But wouldn't IBM working on Linux be self-sustaining? Or, I mean, they're not getting their revenue from working on that, but it's part of the business.
I'm not sure. There are examples like IBM. There's Red Hat, right? Most of them seem to have adopted something that's been created elsewhere and incorporated into their product rather than relying on that as their major source of revenue. So Linux is particularly nice for IBM because it was developed by a whole bunch of folks, you know, sort of working under Torvalds, initially, most of whom, you know, donated whatever time they had, and they were, you know, being fed by some other methodology. You sort of have the basis there. IBM then gets to incorporate that into their products and improve it and work on it as well. But it's not clear yet whether that's going to be a self-sustaining project. Those are the places to watch, I agree. But it's not clear if this is going to be a big part of the innovation economy. So, I mean, we don't know yet. Maybe it's too soon to know. Maybe it's too soon to figure that out. But so far, we are at least suspicious that you may have to have some other means of support to do this. You were...
So assuming that we're going to have both models forever, or at least, you know, practical forever.
Yeah.
And if that's not, then correct me. But if we do, then how do we work this out? So what's going to happen?
And what is this?
This is the ambiguity about which portions of law apply where.
Mm, mm.
We just wait for courts for enough cases to... I'm not a lawyer. So
well, there are several things there. So let me try and unpack that. So part of the reason that we have been looking at the scientific community as a general matter is that, in some sense, we have had both systems for a long time, right? We've had systems like scientific research, again, heavily subsidized by government or by tuition or something like that, doing interesting work for reputational rewards. And then we've had the private system where you get patents and copyrights in return for the research investment that you make. And they sort of lived apart for a long time. For the most part, there were crossovers. I was just at MIT yesterday, and you can see lots of patents that came out of MIT, but there wasn't any big conflict. Now they've intersected. It's been a little uncomfortable, but generally they seem to be able to accommodate each other. Biomedical scientists are, you know, sort of figuring out that if I want to get the reputational reward, I have to do X. If I want to get the patent, I have to do Y. Sometimes my institution will let me do some of each. And there's been some jockeying, but we have figured out mostly how that those things can live together. If you then view the open source type of model as an extension of that, right? And remember that the so-called hacker ethic comes largely out of the academic community, much as the biomedical research norms I talked about do as well. So they have this common ancestor. My guess is that you know, there'll be a little jockeying, and eventually you'll continue to see the two sort of living side by side, sometimes intersecting. And yes, there will be points of conflict, and courts will have to work those out. I guess, right? Now, the funny thing about open source is it's been around for a little while now, right? In one form or another, and we really don't have any cases. I mean, the only case that I'm aware of off the top of my head really looking at an open source or free software type license is a case out of the Netherlands. I believe it was last year, saying yes, they thought the license was enforceable. We've got some parallels in other types of shrink wrap or click wrap licenses, where courts seem to be comfortable enforcing those. So we guess that open source types of licenses will be enforceable, but we don't know. Mostly we just kind of have people rattling sabers and, you know, occasionally get a nasty gram from the Free Software Foundation if you do something that Stallman or Evan Moglen doesn't like. And there hasn't been that much conflict so far, so it may well be that we won't get a lot of decisions very quickly. Would that be odd? Well, in a sense, no, right? For a couple of reasons. The first one is, remember that, you know, even though we've had intellectual property for quite a long time now, that's not what businesses mostly worry about, right? I mean, most business deals are sort of done with a handshake and based, again, on reputation. You know, I trust you to do this deal because I worked with you before and I want to work with you again. And there's a great deal of sociological evidence to that effect. It's only relatively recently that some businesses have gotten very exercised about intellectual property to the point that, you know, in their book information rules, Hal Varian and his co-author sort of remind businesses the point of a business is to make money, not to protect intellectual property. Sometimes you make money by protecting intellectual property. Sometimes you make money by giving intellectual property away. But don't listen to the lawyers and just knee-jerk protect intellectual property. You know, do what works for your business. So we have, you know, lots of court cases and lots of decisions about intellectual property, but far fewer than you might think, given the number of deals that happen every day out in the economy. And so the same may well be true here, right? We may go for quite a long time, with reputation or trust being ultimately the grease that makes the wheels go round. And the other thing is, and this goes back to the earlier question, typically you don't get a whole lot of action in the intellectual property area until there's a lot of money at stake, right? You know, it's the old follow the money principle. And there's, you know, in the big scheme of things, just not that much there yet, right? Now, sooner or later, that will happen, and somebody will decide that it's worth fighting over. But remember, that particularly when we're talking about patents, you can't get out of a patent litigation for less than about $5 million, $10 million is more likely, right? So you don't file these things very lightly. I mean, there's got to be something very worthwhile at stake. There's, again, been a little bit of saber rattling, a little bit of complaints filed, you know, a few sort of preliminary maneuvers in the courts, but nobody's really gone the whole distance yet because it just hasn't been worth it yet. Yeah.
So I'm Alan Friedman, and most of the time I wear an economist hat. Joseph Stiglitz has put together some interesting math showing that prizes will often work in better than sort of an intellectual property regime. I was curious whether you saw that as an easy, a relatively straightforward way out of the legal side, or whether that just complicates the legal matters.
That's been very popular the past few years. My friend Michael Abramowitz has done some work on this, and some other folks have done some work on this. Let's say it's highly contested, right? Whether that's right. My guess, you know, sort of intuitively, would be in some situations, yes, that may well work. In many situations, no, it probably won't work. And we'll have to sort of figure out what those situations are. But that's sort of what the academic argument is about right now, is, you know, is this sort of a limited set of situations where that's viable, or could it be more broadly applicable? I find it kind of amusing because... you remember that this was Alexander Hamilton's viewpoint, right? The French had a system of prizes, in 1790 for meritorious inventions, and Hamilton really thought we should have a system of prizes instead of a patent system. He lost. You know, Madison and Jefferson got this into the Constitution, but maybe ultimately Hamilton will be vindicated in some, you know, someplace, sometime. Yeah.
Legally, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So. You know, the economics, I think, makes sense. On the legal side, does that change, or are there complications once you try to sort of put prizes in place of patents?
Well, it depends on what you mean by put in place of. You know, constitutionally and statutorily, we have a system of patents, not a system of prizes. Now, that's not to say that Congress couldn't create a system of prizes, and in fact, again, you know, sort of fun factoids, there is in fact one place where we have a system of prizes right now. Anybody know where it is?
Nobel Peace Prize.
You're getting close. Flip that around. There is one statutorily excluded subject matter from the patent system, which is nuclear weapons technology. Congress thought that we really didn't want to encourage a lot of private innovation in the nuclear weapons area. And so if you develop a new type of nuclear weapon, you cannot get a patent for it. But there is a system of prizes if you develop a new kind of A-bomb that the Army likes. So, you know, we don't have a lot of data from that on how this could work. But in theory, Congress could put in a system of prizes parallel with the patent system. And I don't see that there would be impediments to that. The question is whether they want to do that. The more interesting question is whether you can do some of this privately, right? Whether you can sort of take patents or things that could be patented and develop some type of private intellectual property reserve type of system where you would give out patents in lieu of prizes if people would either give up their patent rights or dedicate their patent rights to the public. Again, there's been some writing on that. Abramowitz has touched on that and a couple other people have as well. Because it's not clear that there's the political will to do this, so maybe you could develop a private organization. And that is interesting because it really would be running parallel to the patent system. Not a legal problem, but again, more of an institutional design problem. You were going to say, yeah.
Yeah, so under the kind of open source patent model, how do they deal with downstream licensing? So are licensees permitted to license others and the license somehow attaches? There is everything have to come through like the BIOS consortium?
Yeah. You know, much like open source software licensing, where there are a range of things, right? You know, there's everything from the new greater license and the lesser license and the Berkeley model and so on. There are a range of possibilities also in the biomedical area that people are trying to develop. And we've seen examples of both, I think. You know, some examples where you know, yes, you can sort of pass it on and even collect royalties under certain circumstances and license it out because you obtain certain rights in what you develop. Others where, no, that's not possible. It's got to go back into the common pool and then be made freely available again, which, again, is more what BIOS is trying to accomplish. So I think we're going to see development of both kinds of licenses and probably other intermediates and sort of see what flourishes in the ecosystem. But those are all possibilities. Yeah.
One is a comment, and then I'd like to make a question. The first comment is, while you were at MIT, did you visit with Drew Wendy?
No, I was there giving a keynote for a conference, yeah.
So he, are you familiar with synthetic biology?
Yeah.
Okay, so he has his whole concept where they're trying to basically do
yes.
open wetware.
Yes.
You know, very much open source, you know, developing
yes.
Biological components.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that actually is a, they are actually using Linux as a model.
They are, yeah. And in fact, some of the people who have done some of the work that I summarized in the slides, like Artie Rye at Duke University, Jamie Boyle, her colleague at Duke, have been consulting with that group to try and develop those licenses. And they have some of these problems that I mentioned. But yes, they're very there's very much a dialogue going on there. That's another example.
Okay. And then my question was: is you were pointed out how you found it interesting that the academia pushed out this corporate entity that was, you know, Bittner was trying to patent.
Right.
I was wondering why you found that so interesting, shocking.
Well, as I say, typically if we had the same policy discussion in any other industry,
uh-huh.
right? As I say, in the just take the automotive industry. I mean, suppose we said, DeLorean is trying to develop this new kind of car, you know, and a bunch of people with government funding, you know, started throwing the inventions into the public domain and creating a situation where the business model wouldn't work. Normally, as a matter of public policy, we'd think that was a bad thing, right? And we don't typically like to have the government subsidize private innovation out of the marketplace. And so one of the questions is, why do people think it was such a good idea to do it in this particular case? Now, I don't know that everyone in the world thinks it was a good idea, but certainly the biomedical research community thought it was a great idea to run these guys out of the marketplace.
Do you think that maybe points to the idiosyncrasies of the nature of information in the biomedical community?
I think it points less to the idiosyncrasies of information in the biomedical community as to the sort of normative and cultural structure of the biomedical community. It's becoming increasingly clear as we look at these models and how they work that, you know, going back to my business with a handshake comment a moment ago, a great deal of what greases the wheels in all of these organizations is social interaction. Right? We have, at the end of the day, some legal structures that could be relied upon. But the reality is most businesses, most scientific research, most universities, most institutions of any kind that you want to name really operate on the basis of social norms. They only resort to the law when something goes drastically wrong. So a lot of the interesting research, a lot of the interesting institutional design is going to be around those informal interactions and sometimes formal institutional interactions before you ever get to the legal question. So I think that's really where the question is.
I think that biology does have a certain idiosyncrasy. And I think a useful comparison would be, say, between a biological experiment and a physics experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for a physicist to do an experiment, usually the physicist has to start from scratch and actually build a unique machine that's going to make a very specific, unique type of measurement. For biology, it's the inverse, is that the genes are themselves unique, but the methodology used to study those are universal throughout. And so this actually creates a very, creates the situation where we now are generating tons and tons of information that is continuously made publicly available. I think there is a uniqueness to the nature of biology that actually sets it up for exactly the sort of situations that you're talking about.
Well, that's an interesting comment, and I find it interesting in part because part of my thinking along these lines, which is sort of sitting in a manuscript at this point, is orthogonal to what you said, but maybe consistent with it, which is if you think about, for example, high energy physics, mm-hmm. right? Because of that unique machine that you're talking about and the expense of building that unique machine that you're talking about. Physics has, for quite a while now been sort of massively collaborative, right? Where, you have, 50 names on the publication that comes out, or more, right? So-called big science, particle colliders and stuff like that. Whereas biology has typically been small science, right? A research group, maybe even a solo researcher, with some glassware at a laboratory bench. Well, the advent of bioinformatics has really changed that, right? So that things like the Human Genome Project and the associated projects and proteomics and all the other omicses that are happening.
And there's a lot of discomfort with that evolution.
That's right.
In biology.
But it's becoming big science. And so it may be that the norms that have been the expectation in small science break down and you need more formal mechanisms like perhaps these kinds of licenses. That's part of the reason this is interesting for e-science or for cyber infrastructure, right? Is you're going to start throwing people together who've been small scientists into big science, big collaborative groups. They're not used to doing that. They're maybe not even from the same country anymore. International collaborations. Can you manage that on an informal normative basis? Maybe not. What happens when informal norms break down? Well, we resort to law. Maybe that's where we start to need these licenses.
Some of the norms are actually becoming hardwired, particularly in the realm of publication, where in order to actually get your publication, you actually have to say that you're going to make something freely available,
that's right.
For example, in crystal structures or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. So that's part of it as well, I think. How are we doing on time, by the way? Can we take a few more questions?
Or? A couple more questions.
Okay, yeah.
I was curious about what you were saying and was wondering, how has it changed to be a scientist? Are people more likely to belong now to... They have the university community, associations. research groups online. They might join other sort of floating independent projects.
Mm-hmm.
Is the case that more scientists belong to more groups, which are all
yes.
operated very
yes.
differently from
I,
another?
I think that's right. And in fact, there's some very interesting sociological research being done, for example, by some folks here at Boston University, here in town, on the social and collaborative networks of scientists. Some of those provocative results indicate that there's a gender difference, that female scientists have different types of group networking and belonging patterns than male scientists do. The big divide there, of course, is going to be, you know, as it has supposedly been for a while, between academic and commercial researchers. Because supposedly the big advantage of being in an academic setting is I can join whatever group I want to, I have academic freedom, things that look very much like those Mertonian norms, and kind of go wherever my inquiry takes me. If I'm working in an industrial setting, I have some constraints. Now, the curious thing about that, which has been true for about 20 years now, is that in order to get the best scientists out of the academic setting and into the industrial setting, many employers in the private sector, particularly in the biomedical area, have had to promise something that looks like the freedom of academic research. You know, you'll still be able to publish. We might ask you to wait a couple of months so we can get a patent application on file, so you might not be able to publish quite as fast. But you'll be able to investigate the way that you would if you were in a university research laboratory. You'll be able to join groups the way you were in a university research laboratory. And when you get to these big science collaborative groups and these online collaborative groups, then the question becomes harder, I think. You know, we haven't sorted this out yet because it's just sort of starting. But, you know, the private industrial sector scientist wanting to join these online collaborations, these online groups, you have more and more points of leakage for trade secrets, for discoveries before they get patented. And we've had some friction and some trouble, you know, mediating between university research and industrial research, particularly on the trade secrecy question, for some time now. The openness of online collaborations may exacerbate that. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing to see develop. But as I said, there's some interesting social science research on the networking question that you raised. Anything out in cyberspace?
Nope.
Okay.
No questions from the IRC channel or anything else.
All right.
That wraps up the
Thank you very much.
Thank you.